Welcome back to Season 2 of the Distilling Craft Podcast. You are listening to Episode 6, Mushy Mushy Whiskey.
Distilling Craft is brought to you by Dalkeeta, a group of architects and engineers who specialize in designing craft distilleries across the US. More information is available at our website, dalkeeta.com. That's dalkeeta.com.
What's up, guys? This is Colleen Moore from Dalkeeta, your host for episode number 6 of Distilling Craft's second season. Thank you for downloading and listening to this episode today. On today's show, I talk with Christian Krogstad of House Spirits about his world travels, spinning off a brand, Japanese whiskey, and touring Asia like a rock star. But first, we reminisce with him about his road through craft spirits so far. This interview includes a bit of info on the seismic stability of whiskey barrels, and he's even baked in today's safety moment with a nod to our safest lifting practice of all, and that's not lifting something if you don't have to. Take a listen.
Our guest today is going to be Christian Krogstad from House Spirits. Welcome on to the show, Christian.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So tell me the origin story for how you started your business.
So my background is in brewing. I had moved to Portland originally in winter of 1991. And then my final job in brewing was I was managing the McMenamin's Edgefield Brewery. And we had a still there. We had recently brought in a still to make whiskey. I got involved in that from the wash, you know, the wash creation side. Since I was managing the brewery, we were brewing all the beer for the whiskey washes and trucking them up the hill. And I was spending a lot of time up there at the distillery, which was just up the hill. And I got a chance to see what was involved and realized that, you know, it wasn't that far off from brewing. And so I, you know, said, screw it, I'm going to start a distillery. And so I got talking to Lee Medoff, who is the distiller up there, and he and I hatched this plan to start a distillery together. We got it up and running in the summer of 2004 is when we, you know, sort of date of first sale. The purpose, the original goal, and still the goal, was to make single malt whiskey. But, you know, we self-funded it on, you know, savings and home equity loans and eventually credit card debt. So we needed to make clear spirits. You know, this is a kind of a familiar story. We decided to you know, make clear spirits. We also did some contract manufacturing, launched some other brands into the market for people who wanted to get involved. And but all the while we were making some, you know, always making a little bit of whiskey on whatever free cash flow we had. So that was really how we got it going. Very small to start with, originally in a probably 1,200 square foot space down in Corvallis, Oregon, which is about an hour drive south. Then a year and a half later, we moved up to Portland, found a 4,000 square foot space up in Portland, continued to grow through the years. So we started in 2004, and then in, I think, 2008, Lee and I decided to part ways. I bought him out of the distillery, and he went off and started another distillery here in Portland called Bull Run Distilling. We metastasized. So after that, continued to work House Spirits, and you know, at that point, Aviation Gin was our main brand. That was, you know, we had put a lot of feelers out there, created a few brands, and the one that really was taking off was the Aviation Gin. So we were, I think at that point, say, so 10 years ago, you know, in 2009, we were at a little over 4,000 cases. So fairly small brand at that point. Now it's, you know, 80,000, 9 liter cases a year.
Cool.
Yeah. And that, small facility. We were producing the Aviation Gin, the Krogstad Aquavit, some various small, fun, you know, passion projects for, like, you know, coffee liqueur and rum and pot distilled rum, and but also continuing to make malt whiskey. And, you know, we'd always put up 20, 30 barrels a year just to keep learning and keep doing it. But then I met my future partners, and we got engaged and married in summer of 2011. We hitched up. They brought with them, you know, a lot of expertise, but some investment money as well, and that allowed us to really ramp up whiskey production, build a new distillery that we got commissioned in, 4 years ago now, in 2015, the fall of 2015, and upped our production to about 1,200 casks a year of malt whiskey. So that's where we are now. We sold the Aviation Gin brand 3 years ago, but we still produce it. It's a contract brand for us now.
You've just breezed through that in maybe 5 minutes, but I know that between each one of those steps was a lot of turbulence.
Sure.
So how did you deal with that? Because, you know, I know that when you were in your old facility and the city was making you move.
Yeah.
To a place that you did not know what it was going to look like, where it was going to be, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that time period and how you were able to deal with it? Because it's pretty stressful.
It is. It is. There's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in business, whether it's market, you know, the market or your, you know, employee, you know, retention or whatever. There's, you know, there's all kinds of uncertainty. In our case, the main uncertainty was the facility. We were in our first spot that we were in Portland, in Southeast Portland, for 10 years. We had not anticipated the scale that we would get to. So it was originally, you know, we originally permitted it under much more kind of lenient occupancy because we weren't expecting to have the volumes of alcohol that we ended up with. And so we were operating by 2011, 2012, we were operating well beyond our original stated, you know, parameters. And that coincided with the city getting a new hazmat fire marshal. And he really wanted to make an impression. He wanted to put his mark on the town. So he went out and started reviewing distilleries, and we were the first one. And I think at that point we were the largest of them. And so he really hit the books. He didn't always interpret the codes accurately, but that was his prerogative, I guess. So he really, you know, brought the hammer down on us and gave us very little leeway. So we had to go out and find a new space and, you know, build, construct it in certain ways that made him happy.
And so is he your best friend now? Did you work through that?
No, he retired. He retired right after he was done.
Oh, okay.
With that. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty funny.
Okay, so that was the pinnacle effort of his life's work.
Yeah, that was really, that was exactly, that was the, that was his capstone achievement, costing us an extra couple $1 million in construction fees.
But you have a safe facility now.
Oh, the safest. Well, and it's funny that, you know, he was very pedantic about his interpretations, and he wanted to follow code, even in areas that we could demonstrate that code wasn't as safe as more pragmatic solutions. So, you know, he was just, I mean, it was kind of a typical, he was covering his ass, and by being able to point to the code, he could say, hey, you know, I told him to follow code. Code is the highest standard, not, you know, rather than thinking for yourself.
And the thing I think that is important to point out about the building code and the fire code to people that are coming into essentially their first, maybe second construction project on a commercial level, is that the building and fire code is trying to be this living, breathing document that is covering every iteration of building that could possibly exist. So that is anything from a petroleum factory down to a tiny stick-built cottage on the side of a lake. And they're trying to address every possibility in between those two uses to have life safety be a top priority. And so there is obviously no possible way that they could cover every single industry, the industry's needs. And at that time, which was what, 2013-ish?
This is, yeah, 2012, 2013 was when we really got into this.
Yeah, so we were dealing with the 2012 building code in the best case scenario. And, you know, it's evolved. Every iteration, it gets a little bit different. There are things that are passed through this committee process that, you know, go into the code that make it more specific for different industries as we're going through these growing pains. And the distilling, craft distilling industry is a super poster child example, I think, of having that growing pains, because the code would essentially apply to larger scale facilities. And we're talking like Buffalo Trace in Kentucky, you know, and that sense of scale was not something that was accommodated in the building and fire codes at that time. And so you guys had to make a very good case as to, you know, yeah, that's all well and good, but let's look at the scale of what we're doing. And I know that that was fraught with stress and lots of self-care was needed.
Exactly. You know, they don't really make a distinction between kerosene and ethanol. And, you know, because they are both flammable and so forth, they treat them the same. And, you know, clearly, you know, a fireman, an actual fireman, would rather fight a alcohol fire than a kerosene fire. But anyway, so that's one distinction. But I guess one thing I would point out is that there is, you know, there is always the, you know, so there's the code, and depending on your AHJ or whatever.
Right, your local jurisdiction.
They might take the most restrictive interpretation. They might take the most lenient. And, you know, so for us, the two examples, you know, and we had an example in, you know, Portland where they took the most restrictive interpretation of, you know, at every turn, and they were largely uninterested in what the professional engineers had to say.
Tiny bit of a pissing contest going on there, because engineers and architects both have to be licensed in the state that they're operating in, and the building and fire code officials, while they are, you know, officials, right? And they're charged with these duties of enforcing these codes. There's this balance that has to be derived or arrived at between those two individuals of how much is professional discretion and putting your name and seal on it as an architect and or engineer, and how much of it is, you know, laying down the law as the quote-unquote official.
Right, and I think that that's the, you know, in recognition, you know, most, you know, any reasonable code official is going to recognize that the code, like you said earlier, the code can't contemplate every potential situation, and that's why we license engineers, and that's where the code came from in the first place, was from engineers. And so that's kind of the safety valve for, you know, a pragmatic code official, is to say, okay, well, you know, the code says that you can't do what you're proposing to do, but, you know, if you can get a, you know, if a licensed engineer is going to, you know, put their livelihood on the line and say that you can do it, then that's good enough with us. When we went to build our barrel warehouse, our rick house, out in another county, in another jurisdiction.
On purpose, though, right?
Oh, yes. We found that the, you know, much more refreshing approach where they said, well, you're proposing, for instance, high pile storage of hazmat, you know, so spirits above 100 or above 20 or whatever. Yeah, I can't remember the exact.
I think it's 12 feet high.
Well, you can't go above 6 foot for class one or whatever. You know, it's been years now. I'd have to. This isn't my
No worries. So it is a high hazard commodity. Gotcha. And there are height limits, and you wanted to store above it.
We wanted to store above that, and you said, well, you know, you just you need to show me that it's seismically stable.
How did you guys address seismic?
We found we found a seismic engineer who had done a study on palletized storage, and that was that. He was satisfied.
That's how it's supposed to work for everyone at home.
He was like, okay, you know, he's like, he didn't pretend to be an expert. He didn't say, oh, you know, I'm an expert on earthquake, you know, on seismic stability of storage, and I think that you're wrong. He said, no, this guy put a stamp on it, and, you know, you guys are storing it this way. As long as you're complying with the design specifications that this engineer put forth as being seismically stable, then you can do it.
And so we have recently here in Denver had to deal with seismic. They changed the rules a little bit. Recently, they have these maps come out, and suddenly Denver was in a seismic zone. And so we ended up having to essentially strap all the barrels together to make a giant cube of barrels. Is that the approach that you guys took as well?
Exactly. So we palletize barrels so they're stored on end rather than on their side. It is very space efficient. It's also the most, I would say, the safest as far as for back health. You know, you're not handling full barrels. You're not crushing feet with full barrels. You put an empty barrel on a pallet and you fill it in place and you never have to touch it again. And yeah, we put steel strapping around it to make it a solid unit, one around the barrel, two around the tops to tie it to the pallet. And then after that, it, you know, it's forklift, it's pallet jack. You're not having to move barrels, whereas we were originally planning on using Western Squares and storing on the side. We went to try to get seismic stability in studies on those, and there isn't any because they aren't stable. For everyone listening at home, you know, I see people storing flammable materials on those up, you know, 4 and 5 high. You can't go above 6 feet with those anywhere. You know, second layer is it. They're pretty unstable at 3 high and incredibly unstable at 4.
Don't do it. Just say no. But yeah, I've heard that they can go up to 6 high. But again, once you start throwing in like free radicals like seismic loading, it becomes a different story, right? But in the most stable situation, I think they can theoretically, quote unquote, per the manufacturer, go up to 6 high. However, at 5 high, they start to deform the bottom barrel. So
yeah, I've seen them at 6 high in wineries, and I've seen a lot of pictures after that Northridge earthquake of jumbled stacks of barrels, piles of barrels that had been neatly stacked 6 high. You know, I think that there are devices for tying barrels together to make a more, you know, like rods that would go from stack to stack to kind of tie them together and to make a more, you know, stable, cohesive whole. But I think once the ground really starts shaking, it's all bets are off.
They had that big earthquake in Napa, in California a few years ago, and I think that's really when everybody started looking at the seismic stability of that particular storage mechanism. And so I am glad to hear that the manufacturers, because there is more than just Western Square at this point, I'm really glad that they have at least taken notes and addressed that issue. Because I think a lot of times when manufacturers like look at things, something happens, and then they just are kind of like, oh, well, that was a one-off situation. What are the chances that it's going to happen again? Do you know what I mean? Like, those aren't responsible manufacturers. So I'm glad that that particular sub-industry has taken a look at that and addressed, you know, a hidden flaw, I guess, in their initial product. So, yeah, so that's good. So they're being responsible. So you've managed to get through all of that turmoil and get your facility open. It was slightly more expensive than you had initially thought.
Yeah, a couple million.
You know, just a 1 or 2 million, it's fine. But like looking back from when you opened your initial Portland facility, did you plan for growth there? I mean, how did you arrive from opening it to being over your limits and the fire marshal being like, hey, no way, red tag, shut this down?
I think it would be an exaggeration to say that there was planning.
Okay, that's fair.
We found a space that was about four times the size of our previous spot in Corvallis. We thought, well, this is, I mean, when we first moved into the, you know, in the spot that we started operating in January 1st of 2006, it seemed huge. I mean, it was cavernous. There was, you know, lots of free space in there.
Space for days.
Space for days, exactly. And then we started filling it up. You know, we put in a, you know, six 700-gallon fermenters, and we put in another still, started stacking barrels, and before you know it, it was full. So.
The Distilling Craft podcast is brought to you in part by our great sponsors, Fermentis, the obvious choice for beverage fermentation, providing the craft spirits industry worldwide with the best fermentation yeasts for more than 100 years. Contact our sales team to help make your choice on yeasts and products for distilling your next great spirit. For more information or to find a distributor, visit Fermentis.com. That is Fermentis.com.
Welcome back to the Distilling Craft Podcast. In our next segment, we talk a bit about spinning off the Aviation Gin brand, Japanese whiskey, and touring Asia.
Talk to me a little bit about selling off a brand.
Okay.
From your house of brands.
Yeah.
So, number one, did you get to meet Ryan Reynolds? That's everyone's first question.
No. It is. It's pretty funny. You know, he actually hasn't visited the distillery unless he did it in disguise.
Right. Which could be possible.
It's entirely possible. He's an actor. He must have access to good costume and, you know, makeup.
And props and such. Exactly.
But, you know, he's very involved in the marketing of the brand. But he hasn't actually come and distilled a batch yet, which I think he needs to do.
Dang it.
I know.
Yeah, that feels like a deficit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So selling off the brand, how long did negotiations take?
You know, they didn't take all that long, you know, some weeks. And, you know, it wasn't sort of out of the blue. We sold it to the company that was our third party, you know, our sales agent. So the company that bought it had been representing it in the market for years. You know, they were managing our distribution and sales efforts around the country. So they had gotten to know the product, and, you know, normally in something like this, there would be a lot of discussion and discovery around, you know, well, what are your sales volumes and where is it sold? And, you know, they knew all that stuff.
Yeah, they had the inside scoop, if you will.
Basically, we just shifted the line of responsibility. So we, you know, House Spirits Distillery, Westward Whiskey, has always produced Aviation Gin. And, you know, for the last, you know, 6 years or whatever, 7 years, Davos Brands had distributed Aviation Gin. And in there somewhere, the responsibility for marketing it shifted from us to them when they bought the brand. And so that's really all that changed. But, you know, it went from us hiring them to represent it to them hiring us to produce it.
So a little bit change in the relationship. With the sale of that, it seems to me, in following your Facebook feeds and, you know, your world travels and such, that your position freed up a little bit and that you were able maybe to make a little bit more time for things that you wanted to do, maybe like traveling, that also coincided with like a brand expansion with one of your other products.
So as part of, you know, various changes, yeah, I had an opportunity to increase our footprint, and I think that that's been really a big part of the, you know, Westward Whiskey expansion is, you know, getting out of the U.S. a little bit. In some ways, it's easier to get new distribution in other countries than it is to get it in other states. We, you know, we are expanding into Europe. So my partner works on Europe and Australia. I work on Asia. And so, you know, there's some great markets out there for malt whiskey, and I'm happy to visit them.
So tell me, we're going to talk a little bit about Japanese whiskey here, which falls into your Asia market quite nicely. And so Japanese whiskey, just as the background as I know it, and I'm sure people will send me prolific amounts of comments about how this is not as accurate as I'm going to gloss over right now.
Okay? Oh, yeah. I don't pretend to be an expert, but.
So Japan was closed off to outside trade for a long time. They didn't really start trading with the world at large until the late 1800s. And that's when they got an appreciation for Scotch, and they actually sent someone over to Scotland to learn about Scotch, and then he came back. A lot of the Japanese whiskey facilities seem to be in a Scotch style. It looks like they've cut those little malt houses out of Scotland and put them into Japan. And so from there, I believe it was basically two guys. One side became Suntory, one side became Nika. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, I think it started with Suntory, and then the fellow who had gone to Scotland to kind of discover their. I mean, I think the funny part of it is you know, it was this guy Tory, who was he was a chemist, and he went to Scotland in, you know, I think around 1910 to learn the Scottish science of distilling, and discovered that there really was no science of distilling.
Right. It's more an art.
And then, you know, he brought that back and sort of applied some science to it. And that's how we end up with Japanese whiskey.
So what is it that makes Japanese whiskey different from, say, Scotch, which clearly they've studied quite heavily? What are some of the things that make those two things different?
You know, I think a lot of it hinges on, like I said, the science of distilling rather than the art of distilling. Obviously, the Japanese employ a lot of art to it, but the original approach was to apply science to something that hadn't really seen a lot of science. And so they tend to be more precise, almost more deliberate, but, you know, very much inspired by Scottish single malts. And now, you know, fast forward, there are, you know, dozens of whiskey distilleries in Japan now. You know, the big ones, you know, the first one, Suntory, started up, Yamazaki Distillery, and I think it was something like 1923 or something. Yeah. And then, you know, Suntory had existed before that as a beverage company, but then they started the Yamazaki Distillery, I think, in 23. And then the original, master distiller left to start Nika up in Hokkaido in like 1932, something like that. So you know, it sounds like that's fairly recent. But keep in mind, too, that really what we think of as Scotch didn't start until less than 100 years before that. So, you know, Japanese whiskey's been around for 100 years. Scotch has been around for 200 years. And, you know, single malt Scotch has only been around since, you know, 1963. So these things feel like they've always been there, but they kind of haven't.
And so when Scotch is produced, I know that they are a large market for all of our used bourbon barrels, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so the aging is, and the thing that they're using to age in, is it similar in that Scotch style? Are they using the bourbon barrels, or is it a totally different type of wood?
No, they're primarily using used bourbon barrels. There is a native, the Mongolian oak called Mizunata that is used to add a national influence. But Mizunara is not widely used.
So from my reading and research, I have discovered that that particular type of tree only ages things. You have to age in it for like decades in order to get a quality product. It doesn't do things well in like a 4, 5, 6 year time frame. It does it in like 20.
One thing that isn't in dispute about Mizunara is that the wood is very twisted and is, from a structural standpoint, isn't ideal for barrels because it tends to be very leaky.
I think they use that tree and that wood type to make a lot of nice furniture, actually.
And I wouldn't be surprised if there are coopers who are putting in, you know, one or two or a handful of staves in a barrel and having it, you know, a blend of, you know, Mizunara. I'm not wild about the flavor influence of Mizunara, but, you know, I'm not an expert on it. So maybe I just haven't had the good stuff.
Right. And I feel like you may have had more access to the good stuff than maybe I have, having never been to Japan. But that's okay. You can like different things, and you can notice things that are different. That's fine.
I mean, I guess it's also, you know, it's a marketing thing. People want what they can't have or what's in limited supply, and you know, Mizunara is very expensive and it's fairly rare. So there isn't a lot of, you know, Mizunara cask, you know, whatever, Centauri or whatever. So that drives up interest in it because it's, you know, bragging rights, and that's sort of, it's rare.
All right. So tell me about some of the distilleries that you have been privileged to visit, both in whiskey and maybe sake production.
My visits to sake breweries has been very... there's been a language barrier, let's say. I don't speak Japanese, and the people I visited don't speak much English, which I, you know, wouldn't expect them to. But that's been really fun. You know, they have very different process to whiskey production or to beer brewing, or, you know, Western beer brewing. They're very sort of steeped in tradition, and you know, it's they're very Japanese. It's really cool. But for from distilleries, you know, I did have a lot more access to distilleries, and you know, anywhere from some of the largest, you know, Hakushu and Yamazaki, to some of the smallest, like Ichiro's malt up in Chichibu, which is sort of the most popular among collectors right now. And it's, you know, it's, I guess I would say, you know, overall, these facilities are immaculate. They justifiably take a lot of pride in what they do. And it's, they're a delight to visit. I'd encourage anyone who has an opportunity to go to Japan and see these spots to go. I kind of got inside tours into all of these and kind of prearranged with English speakers who could show me around. That's not always the case if you just show up.
So I have an idea that I want to pitch you, and I would totally have to talk somebody else into it. So Scott has a cousin that lives here in Denver who's married to a Japanese woman that teaches Japanese here at Metro State College, and she goes back at least once or twice a year to Japan. My understanding is it's from a fairly prominent family in Japan, and so she's a native speaker. Would you be down for doing a tour of Japanese distilleries with a guide that is fluent in English and Japanese?
I mean, I'm always up for going to Japan.
We can see if we can make it work. It's an idea. You have the distillery connections and I've got the language locked down. So I think between the two of us, we could totally make that happen.
Yeah, we'll talk more about this.
So what are some of your favorite Japanese products? What are you enjoying drinking from there?
It's funny that, you know, like I said earlier, people tend to want the small and the rare and the old. You know, my very favorite of the Suntory products is the Hakushu 12, just their sort of the young malt. It is, I think, their, you know, best foot forward. Very balanced, very flavorful, very drinkable, with a lot of interesting characteristics to it. And, you know, it is a blend of a number of different barrels they're using. You know, some used wine barrels. They're using a portion of peated malt. You know, it's a broad range of flavors, and that's why it's so interesting and complex. So that's, like I said, that's what my favorite thing from the larger, you know, any of the larger manufacturers, distillers in Japan is. But then I also have a lot of fun with the Chichibu products, the Ichiro's malts, because they are small. I think that they're putting down, well, they just completed a new distillery that increases their capacity. I'm not sure how much. I haven't been to the new facility. It's like literally just online this last summer. But before that, I think they were filling maybe around 500 casks a year. So definitely, you know, craft production, that would be something in the range of maybe 12,000 cases a year. You know, really everything they do is small and limited. And they're really good at, you know, including their fans in the process. And so they, you know, they have a lot of different expressions of whiskey that, you know, show different characteristics, whether it's different malts or different barrels or whatnot. Because they are so highly sought after, it can be challenging to find their products. But, you know, when you do, it's always, you know, it's always interesting to see what it is, because there's so much variety in it.
That's cool. So so you've given us a couple of things that we could maybe try at home if we can get our hands on them.
I mean, you can find the Chichibu or, you know, Ichiro's malts, whiskeys. You know, you can mostly find them in you know, online retailers and stuff. You're not going to find them at your local Vaughn's market or whatever, liquor barn. You might. I don't know.
Depends on how good the staff is at the liquor barn, right?
Yeah, and some of these things just aren't, you know, they don't make it into every state, and, you know,
it's like collecting all the state quarters, you know, right? You look at your change every time and you're like, "Ooh, I've got a Iowa."
Yeah, yeah.
So where else in the world have you gone, and what's maybe some of the best things that you've seen or done in the past month, 2 months, 3 months?
We just opened up the Singapore, and we are now available in Singapore, which is pretty exciting. So I've been there twice in the last few months, and that's really fun for me because the food there is so great. Like I said, I travel for food. It's also just, it's a great whiskey market. I think that that's something that, you know, we're finding is that there is a lot of interest in American whiskey around the world. I mean, there's a lot of interest in whiskey around the world, And American whiskey has a good reputation, whether it's bourbon or rye or single malt. And, you know, when we're first introducing it, people assume that it's bourbon because that's what American whiskey is, you know, conflated with. But, you know, people are pretty quickly understand once we start explaining that, you know, well, you can make if you can make single malt whiskey in every other country in the world, why not in the U.S. too? And in particular, you know, Singapore is a very advanced market. You know, they have been a big market for Scottish single malts and Japanese single malts, and so it's just a small intellectual step to go from Japanese single malt to American single malt.
So, how much does the real world kind of parachute into your travels, you know, related to the brand?
So we're also exporting to Hong Kong, and so that has really affected our distribution into Hong Kong. It's just slowing it down, and we don't know where that all is going. But yeah, I mean, you know, there are always considerations. You know, we started distributing in Europe, and then, you know, we're getting some trade tariffs slapped on our products, and so it's more expensive to sell into Europe. We view those things as, you know, they're temporary. You know, the bigger factor right now is just that the dollar is so strong that it makes our products more expensive than they normally would be in export. But you know, those things are, it's like the weather, you know, it's going to change, and when it does, it's going to change for the better.
All you can do is keep your head down and keep going, right? And so you, with the name Krogstad, seem to be quite involved in Scandinavian culture there, and you even recently traveled up to Scandinavia. Tell me a little bit about that trip.
It was primarily a holiday, but visit a couple distilleries in Oslo, and, you know, it was interesting to see, you know, they have a very different approach to marketing and production there. It's, you know, it's a state monopoly, just like in Oregon, but their taxes are quite a bit higher. I was there in June and into early July, and it's a very different culture. You know, the whiskey has always been popular, but aquavit is kind of king. But most of the consumption of aquavit is at home, you know, family dinners and so forth. You know, aquavit is from Scandinavia, and, you know, we really only see about 5 or 6 different Scandinavian aquavit brands here in the U.S. But just as is happening here, you know, in Scandinavia, there's a profusion of craft distilleries opening up, and so you go into a liquor store in Sweden, and there's dozens and dozens of aquavits available.
So were you like a kid in a candy store, and you're like, I've never seen this one. I'll take one of those and and those.
And in certain bars, you know, tried a lot of different aquavits. So, yeah, it's really fun.
And you remember some of the holiday, so good for you.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Well, thank you for talking with me about all your amazing travels. And if you ever need a travel assistant, I'm really good at booking tickets and finding people to give tours.
Okay.
So keep that in mind.
I will do that.
Cool. Well, thanks, Christian. I really appreciate your time and talking with you. You're my favorite foodie in Portland.
All right. Well, let me know next time you're coming out, and I'll take you somewhere new.
A special thanks to Christian Krogstad from House Spirits for joining me to discuss his story in this business and what he's discovered about Japanese whiskey through his travels. He definitely has had an amazing and wild ride, and he's actually so easygoing about all of the ups, downs, twists, turns. I don't know what it is. Perhaps that is a Portland thing. If you're going to the ACSA convention at the end of March 2020, maybe you and I can figure that out together. In our next few episodes, listen for our Portland recommendations to try while you're in town. Portland Dining Month is through the whole month of March, so there are plenty of places to try 3 courses for $33, However, since Christian is from Portland and also the quintessential foodie, I took the opportunity to ask him for his favorite restaurant picks.
Quick before I go, what are your top three choices for restaurants in Portland?
You know, Bullard, I think, is really killing it right now. That's Doug Adams' place at the Woodlark Hotel. There's a seafood restaurant called Headwaters, one of Vitaly Paley's places. It's at the Heathman Hotel. Very, very, you know, beautiful room, great seafood restaurant. You know, I love Trifecta. Unfortunately, they are closing at the end of the year. There's Tournant, T-O-U-R-N-A-N-T. They're open to the public maybe two or three nights a week for various events. The menu is always changing. They'll do a, you know, oyster social or a pozole night, or, you know, it's always changing. So I would say Tournant is a pretty fun spot.
Christian mentioned Bullard at the Woodlark Hotel, and they build that restaurant as where Texas meets Oregon. It's located near iconic Pioneer Courthouse Square, so that one should be pretty easy to find. Headwaters in the Heathman Hotel is a bit north of the downtown district, and while we may have missed Trifecta, it closed at the end of 2019, but the James Beard award-winning chef has a standout pizza joint named Checkerboard Pizza that claims to marry New York and Italian pizza styles together, so that sounds promising. My picks for a nice restaurant would be in Southeast Portland, a place called Clark Lewis, focusing on a Northwest style of cuisine. If you want a vibrant bar scene, I would check out Backwoods Brewing Company or even the Deschutes Brewery and Public House, both of which are in the Pearl District. And if you're looking for a speakeasy with a complex cocktail menu, try the Subterranean Voice in Southeast Portland, which is named in homage to an English architect named Charles Francis Annesley Voice, who was a furniture and textile designer. His early work was simple arts and crafts style that made its way onto wallpapers, fabrics, patterns, and even furnishings. You'll find influences from his life, design, and art throughout the Voice space. If you want a great view of downtown Portland and potentially, depending on the weather, perhaps the Willamette River or even Mount St. Helens, check out Departure Restaurant and Lounge. It is built with a modern Asian food menu and is located atop the historic Meyer and Frank building. And of course, there are the iconic Voodoo Donuts to eat and more beer and coffee than you can shake a stick at. There's actually so many good choices in PDX, it's hard to narrow it all down. We will link all of the restaurants we just mentioned on our show notes page, so you can look one up when you are at the ACSA convention. And just for fun, while you're there, tune into my favorite radio station in the entire country, KNRK 94.7, who is still using the logo that I designed for them almost 10 years ago. God bless them. If I've missed any standout restaurants, send me an email and I will get them listed on our site ASAP.
Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that a giant thank you goes out to you for downloading and listening to this episode of our podcast. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, even if you like just a tiny bit of today's show. It really helps out with our show's vital statistics. If you want more information about this show, go to the show notes on our website, www.dalkita.com/show notes, where we will have links to the people, places, and things mentioned today. There is even a real live transcript of the show to share with all your friends, and you can post a short comment for our team to obsess over, dissect, and even infer your tone and judge your grammar. Our theme music was composed by Jason Shaw and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The final shout out goes to the man that puts all of this together, our sound editor, Daniel Phillips of Zero Crossing Productions. Until next time, seriously guys, stay safe out there. I'm Colleen Moore from Dalkita, and this has been the Distilling Craft Podcast.
Dalkita is committed to getting intelligent and quality design solutions out of the craft distilling industry. Check them out at their website, dalkita.com. That's D-A-L-K-I-T-A.com. Until next time, this has been Distilling Craft. Cheers.